Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
He was very friendly with a lot of fellow cops. He was known as a family man. He'd been married for more than 20 years, had two kids. You know, just, you know, this kind of run-of-the-mill, you know, good guy cop, or so everyone thought.
Welcome to Crimes NZ, hosted by me, Jesse Mulligan. In this episode, we're heading north to hear about crooked cop Michael Blowers. In 2014, the former police detective was sent to prison for 5 years after pleading guilty to a raft of drug-related offences. What made this case stand out is that the drugs he was selling were stolen from the police exhibit room. RNZ's Charlie Drever was a reporter in Northland at the time.
So Michael Blowers was actually a really respected member of the Whangarei community. He was a police officer for more than 20 years, and about 15 of those was in the Organised Crime Unit, which is basically another name for the drug squad. And he held the position of detective sergeant and was actually the officer in charge of the organised crime unit at the time of this offending. And he was responsible for carrying out raids against drug manufacturers and suppliers. And this also meant that in this role, he was allowed access to the police storerooms where they'd keep these confiscated drugs. But outside of, you know, his job, he was really heavily involved in the community. He had a pivotal role in the local soccer club, and he was very friendly with a lot of fellow cops. He was known as a family man. He'd been married for more than 20 years, had two kids. You know, just, you know, this kind of run-of-the-mill, you know, good guy cop, or so everyone thought.
Yeah, and the court case was in 2014, but the offending was a few years earlier.
Yeah, that's right. So it was about mid-2011, between June and June 2012, and it was actually while Blowers was still employed in that senior position. And in fact, he actually kept that position until only about a few weeks before his arrest. Obviously, the cards were on the table, so he resigned, and then a few weeks later, he was arrested for theft of controlled drugs, supplying a Class A controlled drug, which was methamphetamine.
So how was he doing it? What was he doing?
So he had, as I mentioned before, he had access to these lockers that, you know, kept the confiscated drugs. So for people who aren't familiar with the Whangarei police station, there's basically two separate storerooms. One is an internal storeroom, and it essentially worked like a letterbox system where police could drop off evidence, Class A drugs like methamphetamine. And then there was a second bulk storeroom, which was actually outside of the police station, where you'd keep bigger items such as, you know, bags of cannabis, for example. And because this was outside the police office, what Blowers was doing was actually transferring the meth from the internal one out into the external drug locker, and then he could essentially take it out of that without prying eyes and then being able to pass those drugs on to someone else to sell on.
And that's where Mrs. or Ms. A comes in.
Yes, so we're going to refer to her as Ms. A because she continues to have name suppression. But adding to, you know, this offending, Blowers, who was known as a family man, was actually having an affair with a woman who, again, Ms. A, and she was being regularly given methamphetamine, she says, by Blowers for her to then sell on to her criminal contacts. So each time that, you know, he would provide her with methamphetamine, apparently he'd query her about how much he could make from each sale. Apparently it's about a gram each time that he'd supply her. And then he'd constantly pressure her, she says, for cash from those sales and then advising her that, you know, he was under financial pressure at home and he really needed these sales to go through. But he'd had this relationship with her for quite a while, and the police were aware of this. So back in 2002, he was actually told to stop having contact with her. That obviously didn't happen, and their relationship actually went on to be part of a internal police investigation in 2011.
Any sense of what that financial pressure he was under was caused by? What was going on?
No, it's not really clear. I think it was just more, you know, financial pressure at home. I think it was all part of his just pressuring the Ms. A to keep selling the drugs, and she actually ended up owing him a lot of money by the time they got caught, which would later come up in the court case.
Okay, so he's got a pretty good scheme here. Pretty hard to detect what he's up to, but actually it led to another case collapsing. So what happened there?
Yeah, so in October 2011, police executed the search warrant at the Burgundy Rose Motel on Carmel Road. And during that, about 58 grams of methamphetamine was seized. Of that 58 grams, a small sample was then taken to ESR, where they analysed it, and they found that it was actually, you know, very pure. I think it was about 70% from memory. And then the rest of it, about 56 grams, were then transferred to another smaller bag. So the original bag could be, you know, analysed for fingerprints, for, you know, evidence. And that bag that the rest of it got, you know, passed on to ended up being about 56 grams. So they lost about 2 grams going to ESR. But then Blowards got hold of that package, that 56 gram of methamphetamine, transferred it from the internal police locker out to the external one. And at this point, Blowers then took about 34 grams of that meth from the larger, you know, the larger quantity and replaced it with rock salt. so it would still turn up that it was meth, but obviously a lot less potent with 36 or 34 grams rather of rock salt. And then he returned the bag, you know, containing the mixture of meth and rock salt to the original drugstore to then disguise the theft. What happened next was a fluke. Due to the storage, when the case went to trial, they ended up retesting that bag and found that there was significantly less meth in it and a lot more rock salt. Yeah, it was a complete fluke.
High levels of sodium and a little bit of iodine.
Yeah, either way, not great for your health. yeah, so unfortunately, though, this case had gone to trial, and it actually meant that the case fell over, because the evidence had clearly been tampered with, and it meant that two very prominent drug dealers in Whangarei essentially got to walk away scot-free.
Oh, boy. But then I'm imagining that Michael Blowers is feeling rather self-conscious at this point, because some pretty awkward questions would start getting asked.
Yeah, especially because he'd left a paper trail. so, you know, to be able to transfer it from one storeroom to another, you'd need to have a paper trail, and obviously the paper trail led back to Blowers.
Oh, can you explain that to me? So he wasn't sneaking it from one to the other. He was transferring it by legitimate means.
Yeah, legitimate means, although it's kind of questionable, because it does raise a few eyebrows, because usually your Class A drugs would end up going into that internal storage room, because they're much smaller compared to the, you know, your bulk bags of cannabis. But he said he needed to do work in that storeroom, did the paperwork, and then put it back. So it was a little bit, it would raise eyebrows, but not enough, you know, to warrant thinking that maybe he's stealing it. But then when they retested it, it became clear that something had happened to that evidence.
And you've got M Blowers written next to all of the major movements.
Fingerprints so all over it.
Yeah, pretty close. So any idea how much money he was making out of the scheme?
We have a bit of an idea. So obviously in the thousands. We actually have a bit of a breakdown in the summary of facts of the case that went through court. So the largest single amount in one go that Ms. A had paid to Blowers was about 7 grand. And that's just one ghost. There would have been other payments that were smaller than that, but obviously still in the thousands. And Mizay was, you know, unable to keep up with the amount of money that Blowers was asking for. Again, you know, stating those pressures that he was under.
Yeah.
And she estimates that she ended up owing him about 20 grand. So that gives you a bit of an idea of the type of money that he was making.
Okay, what happens at the trial?
So he denies everything. He says, no, it's not me. It's, you know, her word against mine. And it was actually quite sad going to the trial because you saw his family there who were all supporting him, believed him 100%. You know, members of the soccer club, you know, a lot of them actually gave references for him as well. And like his, you know, contribution to the community, even fellow police officers believed him. And were turning up there to support him.
Wow.
Yeah, he you know, just lying to them. And they did. They believed him because, you know, he had 20-plus years in the police. You know, thought he was a good guy. And the court was getting ready for a two-week trial, possibly 3 weeks, because there was quite a lot of witnesses. There were about 40 witnesses in total, which were including police officers. And they were going to have to give evidence, essentially, against one of their own. And one of the really tricky things about this is it's clear that someone had done it who had, you know, access to the storage room. So if it's not Blowers, it kind of turns into a bit of a whodunit,
yeah.
You know. And these police officers, you know, they're not on trial, but essentially you kind of are, because if it's not Blowers, it's someone else who had access to it. But luckily for them, it didn't get to that. Because about day two of the trial, it became very clear that there was some evidence that was going to come up that, you know, he just wasn't going to win. So he folds and pleads guilty, obviously much to the shock of his supporters, who were finding out through the guilty plea. And there was also a charge relating to cannabis that was dropped as a result. And also a guilty plea means that you get a discount on your sentence as well. So when it became clear that he wasn't going to win, I guess the logical thing for him to do was to come clean.
I imagine that the community of Whangarei police officers is fairly small. Everyone would know everyone and it would be a pretty high trust environment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Whangarei, even though it's a city, it's very close knit. And then even more so when you look at the, you know, policing community as well. And this really divided police officers at the time because, you know, there's those giving evidence against him, but many believed that Blowers was innocent right up until the summary of facts were read out, and it became clear that he'd been lying to them through his teeth. And, you know, this guy had been friends with them, trusted them for years, you know, gone to barbecues, to, you know, families seeing each other. You know, it's just, he was a friend to a lot of people. So many people, even when the guilty plea came out, didn't want to believe that he'd actually done this. And, you know, going back through this case and talking to people, some people said to me that this is actually still a sore point for them, still 8 years on.
Wow.
It just really upset them. And I remember even going to the police station after the sentences, for a press conference. And you'd go to the police station often as a regional reporter. I don't know if this still happens nowadays, but back then you used to go for daily police briefings where they'd tell you what happened overnight, and you know, it was quite friendly. But I remember going in after the sentencing and it was just so tense. You felt quite uncomfortable. Everyone was really on edge. And I remember as well, the Northland District Commander, Superintendent Russell LePro, he summed it up really well, saying that, you know, his colleagues had taken his crimes personally. You know, he screwed over other police officers who, you know, whose case fell over because of him. And he said, you know, each officer will have their own thoughts and feelings, but at the end of the day, we can agree that it hurts when someone like this is convicted. So I think that summed up the feeling pretty well. So it was just, really tough for the policing community at that time.
Yeah. I guess we're lucky to live in a country where cases like this are relatively rare.
Yeah. This rarely happens. But actually, by coincidence, there'd actually been another case just a week prior to Blower's sentencing, where an Auckland ex-cop had just been jailed for 8 years for drug-related offending. His name was Peter Paco. And Paco's offending happened when he was on duty and wearing a police uniform. And on several occasions, he'd also used marked police vehicles. It was just this combination, this absolute PR nightmare for the police. It sparked a lot of internal investigations as well. And I think as a result of that, a lot of changes were made about how things were handled.
Yeah. So did Blowers ever say anything in his own defence or try and explain his actions?
Yeah, so before he pled guilty, it was Mize's fault. But then afterwards, he claimed that the gangs were pressuring him to do this and he was worried for the safety of his family. But at the sentencing, the judge, he quickly ruled that out. It was quite interesting, actually. It was pretty... I actually have the judge's quote here. He had to say, Mr. Blowers, that aspect of your explanation does you no credit. So that's pretty brutal. In judge terms, he said, you're a senior police officer. You know and would have been well aware of the resources available to the police. You and your family could have been protected. This inference is that he said the real reason you took the drugs was because your relationship with Mize and in order to make money. And if you and your family had genuinely been threatened by gangs, there were steps the police could and would have taken to protect you. And importantly, your family and you know that. So very formal language there, but in terms of judges speak, that's pretty brutal that he did not believe that excuse whatsoever.
Yeah. What happened at sentencing?
Because he pled guilty, even though he pled guilty during his trial, he actually got a discount on his sentence, and he got 4 years, 9 months. And because, obviously, the Peter Paco case as well, they wanted to make a bit of a example of him as well. He went away, and I remember his defence lawyer, Arthur Fairley, coming out saying, you know, that he felt terribly for the community, he felt terribly for his family, because his family stuck by him through all this. Mm. I think that was the part that was probably the most upsetting, his family stood by him, his in-laws stood by him, and he was sentenced, to 4 years, 9 months imprisonment. If you do the math, he's out now, actually.
Yeah.
And it's my understanding that he's actually been paroled back in Whangarei and is now working in the trades. Obviously, he won't be returning to the police force, given what's happened.
Yeah, and no doubt has lost a lot of what he had before he started committing those crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said before, he was an absolute pillar of the community. In the references that were provided to him by the local soccer club, they were saying that he had a really positive influence on the youth of Whangarei. Before this as well, you'd see him quoted in the media about the big drug raids that they'd done and the drugs that they'd recovered. It was just the ultimate fall from grace from this police officer, and it's still being felt now in the Whangarei community. It was very upsetting, but very filled with drama and definitely a very memorable case.
Thanks for listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. And a special thanks to Charlie Drever for recalling that case. Charlie doubles as producer of Crimes NZ, along with Melita Tull, Sam Hollis and Ayana Piper-Hellian. Thanks also to Liz Garten and executive producer of RNZ Podcasts, Tim Watkin. Find all RNZ's podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.